the one and only Hong Kong visa geezer, Steve Barnes. How
Hello,
are you?
Hello, Phil.
It's been ages.
I know, you haven't been inviting me. I felt so left out.
Good to see you. So basically, Steve is the absolute expert on all things immigration, perhaps if you've just moved here and you want to bring a partner, and give me the two or three real simple ones that people might join in if they've not heard you before.
If you need to take up employment in Hong Kong, you need an employment visa. If you want to establish a business, you need a business investment visa as an entrepreneur. If you're going to join your same-sex partner, which we discussed a lot previously, you need a prolonged visitor visa because, as we've discussed before, dependent visa is not available to same-sex partners. But yeah, those are the kind of things that we're doing every day.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter how simple you think these questions are. He could take the sweat out of your day right now. We are on Facebook Live. Go to our Morning Brew Facebook page and just chuck up any questions there. I've got an interesting one to start with, Steve, from Brian. He wrote to me this morning. He says, following on from a letter in the SEMP today, Ray Buskers and Beggars, how do they get into Hong Kong? He says, other countries like Australia, this is out of your path, I know. Other countries like Australia, you have to prove you can support yourself, place to live, etc. Let me just chuck one thing in here, talking about, let's stick with the Buskers thing if we may, because the others we're going to get into Refugeeville. Tell me about the busker idea.
Essentially, excuse me, when you come to Hong Kong as a visitor, you have to satisfy the immigration officer at the point of arrival that you're a bona fide visitor to Hong Kong.
Right.
And part of that exercise is to demonstrate to the officer's satisfaction that you complete your visit satisfactorily, which means that you have to show that you've got proof of accommodation, you've got sufficient funds to complete your visit, and that you've got a return ticket out, so you've got returnability. Now, whether or not immigration officers are assessing the bona fides of backpackers, I assume the majority of the buskers are backpackers, in fact, sort of making money as they go along and travel around the world. Mm. Whether they're in a position to, you know, drill down on what those visitors are planning to do in terms of busking when they arrive or not is a question they can't really answer, because the immigration department have got lots of people standing in the queue and they've got to process them and what have you. So how do you discern a busker from, you know, another See, general sort of backpacking visitor? It's a tough one.
There must be a reason for Brian Mayer asking me this, but, you know, from what I gather, the world over, you're a tourist, you're a musician, you set up shop, you play, and if somebody moves you on, they move you on. You don't apply for status, although I bet you do in some places.
That's right. There's no immigration status available to buskers at all. Just immigration is not set up for that. So essentially, when you see a foreign national busker on the street, they would either have a visa that would allow them to live in Hong Kong, and then the question of busking as a legal matter is separate, of course.
Yeah. We've never been asked this before.
No, not first time, but I would suggest the vast majority of them are visitors, and they're just, you know, pulling their instruments out, doing what they're doing, raising a few bucks as far as they can, augmenting their funds to complete their travel, and then they scoot on. One might argue that, you know, they add to the social fabric of Hong Kong.
I think so
you,
too.
Of course, being a professional musician, would have something else to say
I'm
about
a
that.
Professional instrument owner these days, but that's a different thing. Let's wind back. A couple of the things Steve's talked about. Yeah. Well, as we have talked about before, but it's been ages, the same-sex thing. I want to return to that in a minute. Now, somebody wants to come and live here. You've said they need to prove X, Y, and Z. Can you assure them that the paperwork is at least not as sweaty as it used to be?
Well, I wish I could say that, but it's not that case at all. We've had significant adjustments in the way that immigration policy is implemented since April of this year, when the Audit Commission reported on the performance of the Immigration Department between 2006 and 2015, where they looked at the Immigration Department's activities implementing policy in relation to foreign nationals, talents, entrepreneurs, professionals and investors. And they got slammed in eight key areas. And as
a result, do you remember the one or two of them?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was. I've got a list here, actually. Processing time for applications for employment visas under the General Employment Policy, and also under the Admission Scheme for Mainland Talents and Professionals. The requirement in every instance now for every application for an employment visa to be accompanied by a proof of a local labour market testing exercise.
So, stop there. Let's do these one by one. What does that really mean?
Well, that means is that if you want to secure an employment visa for a foreign national, previously, whilst there was always a responsibility to address the issue of local recruitment first, the Immigration Department were a little bit more relaxed than they are now. Mm. Now they've adjusted the Immigration Department sponsorship form, which calls for an express declaration as to the extent to which, if at all, you've tested the local labour market.
How the heck are you supposed to do that when you just want to come here and work?
Well, essentially, you put an advertisement in JobsDB or one of the government agencies, and you call for talent, and you go through the interview process, and you assess whether or not a local person can reasonably be expected to do the job or not.
Now, that's an interesting one that we have talked about before. We talked about this with Chef Jason Black. He brought up the topic that, yes, there are fantastic chefs in Hong Kong, but I want this guy, and he lives in South Africa for my restaurant.
Yeah.
Where do we go with that?
Well, it's a continual problem, especially these days where restaurants are delivering typically an experience. And whilst the Immigration Department policy would suggest that you can employ a foreign national chef to be the number one guy and then have an army of local people who are standing ready underneath him to acquire all those skills over time so that they can then essentially be promoted into those
which is very common.
Which is, in theory, very common, but in practice I think you'll find that it isn't the case because of the way that F&B employment tends to be experienced here amongst the local population. Not a lot of locals, unless they're really diehard, passionate, you know, chefs and foodies and what have you, aficionados in this respect.
But I'm not even talking about competition here and that kind of stuff. I'm purely thinking choices, like an artist says, I want to use light blue or I want to use dark blue, and I want the choice to be able to do that.
Yes, so as I was saying, the Immigration Department are responsive to the idea that you can hire a number one guy as a foreigner who's going to then be in a position to impart those skills down further down the pecking order that then locals can ostensibly be in the future promoted into. But the nature of dining these days has shifted from just the production of food and putting it in front of somebody and expecting them to eat it and enjoy it to the actual delivering of an experience. And if you've got a proposition that, say, you're going to deliver on a Greek restaurant experience, then clearly you want to be able to be...
Get a proper Greek chef.
Well, proper Greek chef.
It's not rocket surgery.
You want front-of-house Greek talent as well. You might conceptually, for example, want to bring in a team of plate smashers who are going to do dancing at the end of the evening, you know, that kind of stuff. Now, the Immigration Department are, you know... They're open and receptive to applications.
I think they short-circuit quite easily. It sounds like plate smashers.
Yeah. F&B is tough.
Let's get back to the list. Anyway, you said they got taken to task over a few things.
So labour market testing and salaries, making sure that the salaries that are being paid to foreign nationals are indeed broadly commensurate with market rates, which is part of the approvability criteria and always has been.
Okay.
There were some criticisms about the way that the Immigration Department were approving applications for extensions of stay for people who hold visas under the immigration arrangements for non-local graduates, and they were getting, in some instances, approved on a $9,000 or $10,000 a month salary, which is actually below market rate for a new graduate from Hong Kong. But that's all been addressed as a result of the Audit Commission report.
I'll stay with this in just a second. Talking to Steve Barnes, he's the Hong Kong visa geezer. Basically, he's the go-to guy for the little things that might be really plaguing you right now. As I said, something to do with partners, spouses, employment visas. If you want to ask him a question, go to our Morning Brew Facebook page where you can see his pretty face as well. Let's get back to the list.
Talent list for the Quality Migrant Admission Scheme. We've got this program called the Quality Migrant Admission Scheme, which is designed to attract top-notch talent to Hong Kong. In fact, it should have been called the Quality Mainland Migrant Admission Scheme, because while only 23% of applications ever get approved, 77% of them come from the mainland.
I think we all know this, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's the best kept... No, it's not a secret, basically.
Well, and part of the criticisms that were levied at the Immigration Department and how that policy was configured was this idea that, you know, the structure of the programme doesn't really anticipate the kind of talent that Hong Kong needs at this point in time, because this programme was modelled on similar programmes in New Zealand, Australia, the UK and the like.
They weren't just pitching at one place to suck in their talent from, which unofficially, let's face it, Hong Kong seems to be.
Well, the thing is that whilst the Quality Migrant Admission Scheme was modelled on the programmes from these other jurisdictions, those other jurisdictions are quality of life jurisdictions, and they tend to attract a certain calibre of person that wants to really reinvent their lives permanently. But those programmes invariably are accompanied by an internal list available to the immigration agencies to see if a particular skill set that an applicant possessed was actually hugely in demand, whereas in Hong Kong we didn't have that under the Quality Migrant Admission Scheme. Mm. The consideration process was very much a black box.
It's really fuzzy, this one, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. because, you know, you've got one person in an office who can't be skilled in F&B, music, art, theatre, whatever it might be, and they're the ones who are going to make the decision. Yes, I think he has, you know, has or hasn't enough.
Fair comment, absolutely fair comment. And again, the Audit Commission criticised the way that the Quality Migrant Admission Scheme was being administered in certain areas because of a lack of clarity in recording how the decision-making process was being undertaken. In any event, one of the recommendations that was made as a result of the report was the introduction of a talent list. And so now I know that in cooperation with the Labour and Welfare Department, the Immigration Department are going through the process of determining exactly what a future talent list might look like.
But what they've actually done here, Steve, is what they've done here is added another year to the proceedings because, you know, another department, another form, another board to discuss how they're going to get another board. You know what I'm saying?
It was ever thus, right? This is government. God bless them.
Carry on then. How far through this thing are we?
All right, what else have we got? We've got issues in relation to the quality of documentation. It used to be that the Immigration Department were happy to accept certain self-translated non-government documents.
Meaning what?
Well, for example, if you had a graduation certificate from a university that was in French, you could essentially do a self-translation from French to English and append that to the copy of the diploma indicating that you got the certificate. Now you've got to have a certified translation, so it adds extra time and extra cost to the process.
I think when you're going for this kind of document, even if it's in your mother tongue, even if it's in a tongue that the guys here will understand, it needs to be stamped. Because, like, so-and-so has got a PhD in, you know, flower pots, stamp. This is a fact.
Well, the rules have always been that if a document was not in English or Chinese, it needed to be translated in one of those languages. It used to be that self-translations for certain types of documents were acceptable to the Immigration Department, but as a result of the Audit Commission report and the criticisms that were levied at the department in that report, Now all documents that are being submitted as part of an application have to be translated by a certified translator, which means expense and extra delay.
Across the board on this list, are there a couple more things to talk about? Across the board on this one, let's just pick the juicy ones. They are accused of turning a molehill into a mountain, and we hear this time and time again.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. You see, having practiced immigration for 25 years now, I've seen the Immigration Department sort of go through instances of tightening up in certain areas and making sure that policy was being properly implemented and properly addressed according to their frames of reference, internally having to do the work. But, you know, immigration is an interesting sort of experience because it involves a lot of documents, a lot of different circumstances. No two cases are ever the same. And when it came to actually doing their job and deciding whether a case should be approved or not, there was a certain amount of efficiency put into the process because they got performance pledges to meet. As a result of the Audit Commission report, whilst, you know, that efficiency was in a sense recognised as being in a sense a positive thing, the overwhelming reflection from the report was that it was a negative thing, and so that they should now add this extra layer of bureaucracy. Right. So it's taking longer and it's more work for everybody involved. And actually, when you understand that the vast majority of applications that are structured properly do get approved, it begs the question as to why are we making, you know, much more work.
Well, you know the ins and outs of this department fairly intimately. A couple of weeks back, Long Kok Hung accused the government of improvising too much. In fact, he made some crack about you should join a jazz band. Now, using this as an example, are they basically busking the way their procedures go? It'll change. It'll go from this to this.
No, not at all. It's the policy is coming into much clearer focus now. It's very much sort of down the line, black letter law. This is how it has to be. Some of the traditional flexibility that the Immigration Department were prepared to avail in certain circumstances as in a sense been washed away because we now have to do things a particular way because they got criticised for being as flexible.
Everybody's
as
got a caveat though, haven't they, in their story? I don't know, I mean, you've got experience with England and Aussie and all that sort of stuff. Are they as tight about it?
Yeah, Actually, truth be known, one key facet, for example, in Australia, when you file an application, which, by the way, is probably going to cost you tens of thousands of Hong Kong dollars, where here it only costs $190 on approval, but as part of the filing fee in advance, tens of thousands of Hong Kong dollars, the expectation is that all the paperwork is going to be there in one place, ready to go.
And so if your difficult to do that.
Well, if your paperwork isn't all in one place, they give it back to you, and you could very often lose your fee. So the onus on you as an applicant was to make sure you had all your ducks lined up, all the T's.
You've got to make it easy. You've got to spoon feed them.
Indeed. And so now the Immigration Department have just sort of aligned themselves with the way that immigration is practiced in other jurisdictions after all.
Pick one more. If you've just joined us, I'm talking to immigration expert Steve Vines, Visa Geezer. And we've got a couple more minutes if you want to go to our Morning Brew Facebook page where we're live. And if you've got a question, just chuck it up there. Pick one more, Steve, that is perhaps a favourite of yours.
Collection of relevant data.
Go on then.
Well, for example, under the business investment visa as an entrepreneur, when the Audit Commission looked at the extent to which the implementation of policy for that visa type was actually benefiting Hong Kong, there wasn't the necessary data for them to conclude whether or not there had been any benefit to Hong Kong, because the Immigration Department weren't collecting routinely the amount of capital that was being invested at the point of approval of the visa, or what the amount of capital was going to be in the following 2 or 3 years. That data wasn't available. In fact, the Immigration Department's systems didn't even have places inside the computer database to capture that data.
Yeah. Right.
Similarly, the total number of jobs that were going to be created at the point of approval and in the years that followed.
Right.
So that if you're assessing under that visa type positive impact to Hong Kong, you're obviously going to say, well, what's the amount of capital that's being invested and what are the total number of jobs that are being created? That data wasn't being collected. Now the Immigration Department routinely collect that data.
Let's try and give this a happy ending, a nice coda here. So they've been told you're being a bit sloppy, you're being long-winded, it's time to get your act together. This was the Audit Commission, right?
Yeah.
Right. What have they said, pledged, as they like to do, that they're going to do about it?
Well, the government immediately accepted all the recommendations for change, and the Immigration Department have been implementing all of those recommendations for change, and that's the kind of stuff that we've just been discussing.
So hopefully, when we talk in a few weeks' time, into 2017, we'll be able to have some tangible answers to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're seeing it now because it's been 5 or 6 months since the changes have been introduced.
Okay.
We have to work harder for our approvals now. We have to set clients' expectations that the process is going to be harder. It's going to take longer. They're going to have to be more engaged in the application. And for those poor souls that are a little bit lazy in putting together paperwork,
that's the thing, isn't it?
Not good news for them.
Check, double check.
Right. Triple check through.
Anyway, Steve, have a happy Christmas. Thanks for coming for a visit. Looking forward to our next one. Steve Barnes is the Hong Kong Visa Geezer.